Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in northern Iraq for talks with Kurdish leaders on expanding the battle against the Islamic State group. Carter arrived at the Erbil airport today, greeted by the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region. The Iraqi Kurds have emerged as a key force in the U.S.-led fight against Islamic State. Carter told reporters today the Kurdish Peshmerga have performed very well. He said they've been what we look for in all of this conflict as capable, motivated forces who can defeat ISIL and govern territory as appropriate. The Islamic State group has now launched an FM radio channel in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports.
Local journalists say the FM channel has been active for almost a month and can also be heard in the provincial capital, Jalalabad. Local provincial council member Zabihullah Azmarai said the broadcast tries to convince the local population that their current system is un-Islamic. Local journalist Anat Khan, who has heard the broadcast, said the population is scared. They say that they will fly the black flag first in Kabul, then in Islamabad, and afterwards in all the capitals of the Muslim world, said Khan. According to the Afghan TV channel Tola News, a spokesman for the provincial governor said they are making efforts to get the station off air. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
U.S. and Cuban officials have reached agreement on restoring regular commercial flights between the former Cold War foes after more than 50 years. Delegations from both nations have been meeting in Washington since Monday to finalize details of the deal. Several major U.S. airlines have expressed interest in flighting regular routes between Cuba and the U.S. This is VOA News. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is warning that Burundi is on the brink of a civil war that could threaten the entire region.
What we have seen over the past few days is chilling. I have asked Mr. Jamal Ben Omar, my special advisor, to go to the region before the end of this week to speak to the African Union, the countries in the region, and of course the government of Burundi. An inclusive political dialogue is needed urgently. We must do all we can to prevent the mass violence and act decisively should it erupt.
The African Union is demanding an end to the violence in that country, warning it will not allow the country to descend into genocide. The AU Peace and Security Council is concerned political violence could trigger a civil war there with the kind of ethnic conflict that led to mass killings in neighboring Rwanda in 1994. The council today on Twitter said Africa will not allow another genocide on its soil. Russian President Vladimir Putin in his annual news conference with reporters says he is ready to work with any president elected by the American people to develop better ties with the U.S. Regarding Syria, Putin said the Russian military operation there will continue until the start of a political process with the Syrian people to determine who rules the country. On Turkey, which recently shot down a Russian warplane, Mr. Putin said he sees no possibility of overcoming the strained ties with the current Turkish leadership and expressed shock that Turkey hadn't tried to explain its action but turned to help from NATO instead. Ukraine says it will suspend trade with Russian-occupied Crimea by mid-January. Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk on Wednesday said the ban begins in 30 days and affects everything but humanitarian aid. China is now lodging an official protest and threatening sanctions against companies participating in a U.S. arms deal with Taiwan. The U.S. State Department formally notified Congress Wednesday of its plan to sell two naval warships, anti-tank missiles, amphibious assault vehicles, and Stinger surface-to-air missiles with a total value of $1.83 billion in arms to Taiwan. China regards Taiwan as part of its territory and is threatened to invade the island if it declares independence. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said this latest arms deal is consistent with the U.S. commitment to Taiwan.
Today's notification is consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act and U.S. support for Taiwan's ability to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability. I would hasten to add that there has been no change to our longstanding One China policy that's based on the three joint communiques and the Taiwan Relations Act.
A spokesman for China's foreign ministry urged the Obama administration instead to cancel the sale and do something more conducive to U.S. and China relations. Global investors are welcoming the U.S. central bank's decision to raise interest rates, that decision announced yesterday. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
I'm alarmed by the escalating violence in Burundi. What we have seen over the past few days is chilling. The country is on the brink of a civil war that risks engulfing the entire region.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon calling the world's attention to the crisis in Burundi. Also, members of Libya's rival government sign a peace deal despite concerns about the legitimacy of the much-disputed pact. Students from the Oromo ethnic group in Ethiopia are protesting against an urban expansion plan around the capital. And Rwanda is expected to vote yes in a constitutional referendum tomorrow that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in office in 2017. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned yesterday that Burundi is on the brink of civil war. Ban called urgently for restraint and dialogue to stem the country's escalating political conflict and said the United Nations could increase its presence and activities in Burundi depending on how the situation evolves.
I'm alarmed by the escalating violence in Burundi. What we have seen over the past few days is chilling. The country is on the brink of a civil war that risks engulfing the entire region. I have asked Mr. Jamal Ben-Omar, my special advisor, to go to the region before the end of this week to speak to the African Union, the countries in the region, and of course, the government of Burundi. An inclusive political dialogue is needed urgently. We must do all we can to prevent the mass violence and act decisively should it erupt.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. In Geneva, Lisa Schlein reports from a special day-long session of the UN Human Rights Council on the deteriorating Burundi situation.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad al-Hussein opened an emergency session of the Human Rights Council by describing escalating atrocities, intimidation, and hate speech in Burundi, saying it harked back to that country's deeply troubled, dark, and horrendously violent past.
Burundi is at bursting point on the very cusp of a civil war. The time for piecemeal responses and fiddling around the edges is over. The situation in Burundi demands a robust, decisive response from the international community.
The High Commissioner said at least 400 people have been killed since April 26th when Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza announced his intentions to run for a third term, considered by critics to be unconstitutional. He said dozens of people may have been extrajudicially executed in November, some 3,500 have been arbitrarily arrested, and nearly 250,000 people have fled to neighboring countries in fear of their lives. The Secretary General's Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Adama Dieng, said there were clear warning signs in Burundi of potential atrocities.
In a speech on 29 October that received much attention, Reverend Dikuriyo, the President of the Senate, used inflammatory and threatening language that could constitute incitement to violence. Some of the language used was very similar to the language used before and during the Rwandan genocide.
Hutu extremists killed about 800,000 people, mainly Tutsis, in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Despite the warnings and condemnations by delegates, the government of Burundi was not persuaded it had a case to answer. Speaking through an interpreter, Burundian representative Elisa Inkeraberori accused the opposition of undermining democratically elected institutions.
The government of Burundi today seeks a firm condemnation by the international community as regards the radical opposition, which is organizing attacks against Burundi from outside.
She said her government favored inter-Burundian dialogue as the only way to resolve socio-political problems in Burundi. On this point, the international community was in agreement. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A look at more developments. Members of Libya's rival governments have signed a peace deal despite concerns about the legitimacy of the much-disputed pact. Delegates signed the UN-mediated agreement today at a ceremony in Morocco. The peace deal is an attempt to end the instability that has marred Libya since the 2011 ouster of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi. It calls for a new unity government within 40 days, with members from the internationally recognized government in Tobruk and the Islamist-backed body in Tripoli. Even with participation from both sides, it remains unclear how many people support the agreement and who would sign it. Rwanda is expected to vote yes in a constitutional referendum tomorrow that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in office in 2017. There has been increased pushback around Africa to do so-called presidents for life. I spoke with Nick Long about why so many Rwandans want Kagame to stick around.
Most observers seem to think this is a done deal. They expect that, as in previous elections, that there will be a yes vote for the proposed constitutional changes, the main one being that the presidential term limits should be reformed. Currently, the constitution allows two seven-year terms to a president. The reform is to actually reduce that to 2 5-year terms, but to introduce a transitional period of 7 years from 2017, which is when the current president's term runs out, when the current president could stand again. So President Kagame could, if he wishes, and he hasn't made clear whether he wants to, but if he wished to, could stand for that 7-year term and could then run again for another 2 5-year terms. So he could, in theory, be in office until 2034.
Is this what the people want? Do they want to see him stay in power?
It's very hard to know. Rwanda is not famous for freedom of expression, but there's no doubt that President Kagame has a lot of support around the country for what he's done in the past 20 years since he rescued the country from genocide and built up the country from the ashes. And he is generally regarded as a model of developmental good governance. He's been very good for development and for providing public services, health services, and so on. And I think a lot of observers think that the ordinary Rwandan appreciates the peace, the security, and the public services that they enjoy under this current regime. So it could well be that if this were entirely free campaigning, which there isn't, but if there were, that Kagame would win.
What is the opposition saying about this proposed referendum?
Well, there is one major opposition party which is calling for a no vote, led by Frank Habineza. That's the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda. They're saying that while Kagame has been good for the country's development, they believe he should not stay on after 2017. They say that that would be a threat to peace and security, and that they believe he's given the country steady progress, but to maintain that progress and economic development, the country also needs to respect its laws, including its presidential term limits.
That was VOA's Nick Long. He spoke with me from Bangui, CAR. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. UN human rights officials warn Burundi is on the verge of civil war and the international community must take action to avert this looming catastrophe. Members of Libya's rival governments have signed a peace deal despite concerns about the legitimacy of the much-disputed pact. And Rwanda is expected to vote yes in a constitutional referendum Friday that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in office in 2017. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Well, students from the Oromo ethnic group in Ethiopia have been protesting for 3 weeks against an urban expansion plan around the capital that they fear will lead to land grabs without proper compensation. Security forces have clashed with demonstrators, killing at least 5 people this week. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
The student protests have spread quickly through the Oromo region that surrounds the capital. Farmers and other citizens are joining the demonstrations. The government accuses some of the protesters of trying to destabilize the country. One resident, who wished to remain anonymous out of concern for his safety, says security forces deployed to the region are controlling many access points to stop more people from joining the movement.
Most of the protesters are farmers. They came from the rural village into the town. The defense forces already, some of them left to the local area, to the rural village. The police is also arresting some of those participants.
The Ethiopian government says it can confirm 5 deaths from clashes with security forces, while opposition groups say 60 people have been killed so far. Amnesty International said Wednesday the protests are being violently suppressed. Protests against the Addis Ababa Integrated Regional Development Plan also erupted in April 2014, resulting in mass arrests and several dozen deaths during clashes with security forces. The master plan is an expansion blueprint for the capital. Citizens in the surrounding Oromo Federal Regional State say they are concerned the proposed infrastructure will gobble up their land and endanger their cultural heritage. Oromos are the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, making up about a third of the population. The government promised to hold inclusive consultations on the master plan after the 2014 protest. Opposition leader Merera Gudina of the Oromo People's Congress says those discussions were never held.
We tried several times. They refused. Then we tried to organize open public meetings. They again, and they refused. They blocked us. Then what you got is this. People are really fed up of this government, their life. Especially the young people are fed up of everything.
Merera calls for the scrapping of the master plan and transformation of the regional government. The government says the master plan has not been implemented yet, though opposition groups allege that farmers are already being evicted. Protests in Ethiopia are rare. The ruling party has been in power since 1991 and won all seats in parliament during the last national elections in May. But tensions are there, says Hallelujah Luli of the Institute of Security Studies.
I think what we're witnessing is an unprecedented level of protests. And I don't think the security forces and the government was prepared for such level of movement. And I believe, showed us the ill-preparedness of the state to handle such kind of demands.
Ethiopia is one of Africa's fastest-growing economies. Still, almost a third of its population lives below the poverty line, and millions of people are affected by an ongoing drought this year. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Refugee camps in Cameroon continue to see a steady influx of displaced civilians from both Nigeria and Cameroon as soldiers intensify raids against Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinziga accompanied a team of UN officials and diplomats to the Minawal camp in Cameroon's far north region and has this report.
62-year-old Abubakar Salifu has just arrived at the Minawawo camp in northern Cameroon. He tells UN officials how he escaped with his wife and 4 children from the town of Banki in Nigeria just 4 days ago. He says insurgents had just looted the cows and shops when Nigerian and Cameroonian soldiers arrived. He says the soldiers have been carrying out raids on suspected Boko Haram strongholds. Cameroon's Minister of Youth Affairs and Civic Education, Monuna Futsu, says 800 people have been arriving here every week for the past 2 months. The camp now hosts more than 55,000 people, with about 50 babies born here each month, he said.
The humanitarian crisis here in Far North is very preoccupying, and displaced persons and refugees constitute a challenge for the government and its partners.
The now 6-year-old Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria has spilled over into Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Militants have targeted civilians, razing villages and killing residents. An estimated 20,000 people have been killed and over 2 million displaced, according to UN figures. Cameroonian troops have joined Nigerian soldiers this month in fresh operations to chase militants from remaining strongholds around Lake Chad and in the Sambisa Forest in northeast Nigeria. Visiting the Minawawo camp, U.S. Ambassador to Cameroon Michael Hoza said the main goal is defeating Boko Haram. The U.S. has sent military advisors to the region and just last week gave Cameroon's military armored vehicles, generators, and other tactical equipment.
We hope to increase our efforts to eliminate Boko Haram permanently so that the Nigerians can go home and we can restore the economy and people can get back to doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is raising their families and building a bright future.
The refugees sang as officials departed the camp. Aid workers at Minawawo say sanitation, health care, and adequate food for the growing population are among their top needs. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Minawawo, Northern Cameroon.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. In Uganda, a court case involving two women who died in childbirth at government hospitals could have widespread legal implications. A Supreme Court ruling has opened the door to lawsuits in cases where the government fails to provide proper health care. Sergino Rusblat has more from Kampala.
The two women died during labor at government hospitals in 2009 and 2010 after medical staff refused to treat them because they couldn't pay bribes. Childbirth care is supposed to be free in Uganda. According to David Kabanda, the lawyer representing the families of the two women, the government is responsible for their deaths.
Who is supposed to build hospitals? It is the government. Who is supposed to facilitate hospitals with enough skilled manpower, enough health commodities and other goods? It's the government.
The Constitutional Court refused to hear the family's initial petition filed in 2011. Judges said they didn't have the authority to rule on matters such as hospital budget allocation, which is under the executive branch. But Uganda's Supreme Court dismissed that decision in November and ordered the lower court to hear the case. Peter Walumbiri, a constitutional expert, says the ruling of the Supreme Court is a significant one.
This decision opened the door for litigation in this area. It opened the door for the courts to now scrutinize government policies, government actions, government omissions. It has far-reaching implications if the public in Uganda were to take advantage of this landmark decision.
Experts don't expect the courts to be flooded with petitions anytime soon, but Salima Namusobia of the Initiative of Social and Economic Rights says they are preparing cases that could take advantage of this new president.
In my organization, there are also cases to do with, for example, budgets for education, but also issues to do with failure to provide an education for particular groups of people. So there are places, for example, that do not have public schools, and you would be arguing issues of equality and non-discrimination because these are places that are supposed to benefit equally from public resources, just like the rest of Uganda.
Kabana says the case of the two women who died is already having an impact.
From when we filed the petition, we have seen numerous changes. from the government. We have seen them do maternal death audits. We have seen them increase on the number of health workers. We have recently even sued the local government, which didn't supervise its health workers and which resulted into death. And they've been condemned in costs. They've been condemned to pay damages.
Uganda's Constitutional Court is expected to take up the case of the deceased women sometime early next year. Serginho Rosblatt for VOA News, Kampala.
In other news around the world, U.S. and Cuban officials have reached agreement on restoring regular commercial flights between the former Cold War foes after more than 50 years. Delegations from both nations have been meeting in Washington since Monday to finalize the details of a deal they have been working on for several months. Several major U.S. airlines have expressed interest in establishing regular flights to Cuba, including American Airlines, Delta, United, and JetBlue. News of the agreement comes a year after U.S. President Barack Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro announced the nations were restoring formal diplomatic relations that were severed shortly after communist leader Fidel Castro overthrew the island's longtime dictator in 1959. Obama eased travel restrictions to the Caribbean island in September, but general tourism is banned by the U.S. trade embargo, which can only be lifted by Congress. The U.S. State Department said the new agreement would lead to increased authorized travel to the island nation, 145 kilometers off the southern U.S. state of Florida, such as for educational trips, even though tourist flights are still banned. It said a stronger U.S. civil aviation relationship with Cuba is a critical component of Obama's effort to normalize relations between the two countries, which have already reopened embassies in Havana and Washington. This is African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. And for listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up right here on the VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I get you. This one I get you.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. UN human rights officials warn Burundi is on the verge of civil war, and the international community must take action to avert this looming catastrophe. Members of Libya's rival governments have signed a peace deal despite concerns about the legitimacy of the much-disputed pact, and Rwanda is expected to vote yes in a constitutional referendum Friday that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in office in 2017. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with boxing today.
Yes, Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Namdi.
And a good evening, Sunny.
Namdi, let's begin our end-of-year boxing chat with the big boys in the heavyweight division. Tyson Fury, a very big British boxer, wins the world heavyweight title. He beat Vladimir Klitschko, but the IBF strips Tyson Fury of the belt. What is that all about, Namdi?
Well, Sunny, when they made the deal for Klitschko and Tyson Fury to fight, there was a rematch clause, which means there has to be an immediate rematch. And IBF did not know about this immediate rematch clause. So with a big upset of Klitschko and Tyson Fury going for the rematch, then what happens to the number one contender who is from Ukraine, you know? And IBF said, no, this cannot happen. You must face the number one contender, Vaclav Glaskov, or you lose the title. And then what happened is that Tyson Fury said, no, I don't need your title because I still got the WBO and the WBA title.
Well, we'll talk about the Fury-Klitschko rematch, Namdi. But first, let's go back to the fight. What did you think of Fury's performance against Klitschko?
It was a boring fight, Sonny. I expected Fury to really knock Vladimir out. For our listeners, Sonny, you know how we make fun of Vladimir and his jab and grab style, you know. That was the best thing to happen to the heavyweight division because this guy sat on three belts, you know. It was a very ugly fight, but the fight fans believe the best man won, and I think it's good for the heavyweight division.
Namdi, when do you think they'll fight again in 2016?
Well, they're looking at somewhere around April or May. The discussion now, is this fight bigger in Germany or is this fight bigger in Europe? We're talking about in the UK, the Wembley. In Germany, Klitschko is pulling 50,000. But right now, he's not the champion. Tyson Fury is the champion. This fight means a lot in the UK, and I think Tyson Fury can fill up the Wembley.
What did you think of Fury's antics in the ring, putting the gloves behind his back and taunting Klitschko?
Well, he took Klitschko's mojo away from him before the fight. In the fight game, we read body language before the fight. Right from the press conference to the inside the ring, Klitschko was really scared to fight. Go back and look at that fight. Klitschko was really, really scared because Tyson Fury really took away his mojo.
Today was not a good night for me to win this fight. I wish there will be more clean shots that I could land. I couldn't find the right distance and land those shots. Tyson was quick with his hands and his body movement and his head movement. I couldn't land the right punches. I congratulate him tonight. He won the fight, and to be continued.
The second fight will be much easier because Vladimir will want to force the fight, and in the process of forcing the fight, he will get knocked out.
Speaking of knockouts, Namdi, Tyson Fury, named after that knockout artist, Mike Tyson. And yet, when I compare those two, Namdi, I just don't see Tyson Fury as being the future of the heavyweight division. Your thoughts?
No, he said he makes all these outrageous statements outside the ring, and he's a very colorful character too. I mean, he's not boring guy. He will really hype the fight. He will talk up the fight. That's what we need. We don't need a boring champion that will put you to sleep with his style. This guy will make you want to buy a ticket. This is what the fight game is all about. In the ring, he's okay, he's sloppy, but, you know, he's an entertaining guy, and that's what the champion is all about.
Tyson Fury getting a lot of headlines these days in the UK, Nnamdi, and so is another heavyweight with Nigerian ties, VOA! Tell our VOA boxing fans about that.
Sonny, his name is Anthony Oluwafemi Olaseni Joshua. He is the British and Commonwealth heavyweight champion, 15-0 with 15 knockouts, Nigerian mother, English father of Nigerian and Irish descent. He's the true Niger boy.
Do you see him making his mark in the heavyweight division, Nnamdi?
Definitely. Before Saturday night, I looked at him like a dubious heavyweight because, you know, 14-0, so who did he knock out? Bunch of guys from the motor pack, you know. But Saturday night, he put on a great show with a guy that had him on the floor in the amateur, in Dylan White. He had him in trouble. He knew when to just close in and look at the hand speed, power in both hands, and then to watch him drop that uppercut, the right uppercut from down and under. It was bang! That was it. Fight was over in the seventh round. This guy is a force to be reckoned with. At age of 26 and 6'7", AJ is a force in the heavyweight division.
He's got the size for sure, Nnamdi. Tyson Fury, also really tall fighter. Now, I'm just wondering, why isn't Tyson Fury the British heavyweight champion?
Well, he doesn't really need a title, a British heavyweight champion or European champion. Tyson Fury just believes focus was just on Klitschko, Vladimir Klitschko, and that's why he went for the world title, which was a bigger title for him. That's why he didn't want to really go for the British title or the European title.
Thanks, Nnamdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. And Nnamdi will continue his look at boxing in 2015 during Friday's Sunny Side of Sports.
Galala! Great show, bro.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Now let's go to Mogadishu, Somalia, where football history was made on Thursday. The military club Horseseed defeated the police club Hegan FC 2-1 in the final of the General Daoud Cup, the first football match broadcast live on television across Somalia. Somali National TV showed the game, and it was also streamed live on the SNTV and Somali government websites. Reports from Mogadishu say thousands of jubilant Somalis attended the game, while thousands of others watched the game on TV and on their computer screens, both locally and around the world. Somali Football Federation President Abdikani Saeed Arab says the first time live television coverage is a milestone in a country recovering from decades of violence and conflict. He says the federation will try to get more matches shown on television in the months to come. From Mogadishu, let's go south to Johannesburg, where the South African Football Association is looking forward to the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Mark Ouma reports.
The South Africa Football Association, SAFA, has set targets for their men's and women's teams that have qualified for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. SAFA National Executive Committee member Nomsa Mahlangu has the details.
Our celebrities, the team that qualified for the Olympics 2016 in Rio, and Banyana Banyana, the team that paved the way for us as the under 23 to be able to qualify. I think it's important for South Africa to realize that Vision 2022 is a reality, because the vision says we want to be top three in Africa and we want to be in the top 20 in the world. And having qualified for the Olympics in both the men and women means that at under 23 level, we are part of the top three, and also in women's football.
That was Nomsa Mahlangu, South Africa Football Association and National Executive Committee member. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thank you, Mark. The world champion U.S. women's national soccer team lost to China Wednesday night 1-0 in the final match of Abby Wambach's great career. The veteran American star, world football's all-time leading scorer with 184 goals, threatened to score several times in the friendly match played in the southern U.S. city of New Orleans, Louisiana. Abby played 72 minutes before leaving the field. The 35-year-old Wambach kicked off her cleats and hugged each of her teammates and coaches as the record crowd of nearly 33,000 in New Orleans chanted her name, Abby, Abby, Abby. Abby's fond farewell was spoiled a bit, though, by the loss. It was the first for the American women on home soil in more than a decade. Wang Shuang scored for the Chinese in the 58th minute on a volley that deflected off Megan Klingenberg of the USA and into the right corner of the net. China's victory ended a 104-match unbeaten streak for the American women here in the United States. The world champion American girls' last loss was against Denmark in 2004 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But I think I'm going to remember Abby Wambach more than that loss to the Chinese. In a related story, midfielder Carly Lloyd has been voted the 2015 U.S. Soccer Female Player of the Year. Carly played against the Chinese. She also was given the golden ball this year as the top player at the Women's World Cup. Lloyd rocked the world when she scored the fastest goal in World Cup final history. She also became the first female player to score a hat trick in a World Cup final. She was definitely the inspiration behind the world champion U.S. women. Carly got all three of those goals against Japan in the final in a 16-minute span. Wow, that's fast. She also won the silver boot as the second leading scorer at the Women's World Cup. Carly Lloyd, the 2015 U.S. Soccer Female Player of the Year. She's also up for FIFA World Female Player of the Year next month in Switzerland. I think she's going to win it. I think she's going to win that award too. Carly Lloyd, you heard it here first. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, remember now, Sonny said it first. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, an academy in New York City helps refugee kids adjust and flourish in their new environment. And Zimbabwe introduces a new land tax for resettled black farmers. First, here's Judith Tefera of Ethiopia with Wadoje.
Yes, I know that I'm all, but I've
Judith Tefera with Wadoje. While the United States is a top choice for refugees and others seeking a new life far from war, oppression, and other instability, once they get to the U.S., refugee children face the challenge of learning English and attending an American school. In New York, a six-week program called the Refugee Youth Summer Academy helps children from dozens of countries to succeed in the vast public school system. It's a process documented in the new film, Refugee Kids, One Small School Takes on the World. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee, which sponsors the academy, about the role education plays in helping refugee kids adjust and flourish.
Education is important not only to us, a value that Americans place a very high value on, but also something that refugees themselves place an incredibly high value on, and a real source of stability and something that's going to help them to regain that control over their future. Our students will be entering the public education system. However, that system is incredibly complicated. There are many layers, especially here in New York City. Our students may have had the benefit of a strong education, or they may have been educated in a refugee camp, or they may have been in unstable urban settings. Their educational experience of a head start on what that's going to be like, and that student is then going to raise their hand during the first week of school rather than waiting 3 months or 6 months to do. Experience is rarely similar to what they will experience when they enter school in the United States. So it's really essential that we give them a little bit of that. It welcomes them into the school system rather than dropping them into this very overwhelming, not always that friendly environment.
Tell me a little bit about the school itself now. What was the impetus for creating the school? How is a refugee as a term understood? Was this just anybody who arrived, people who've had to have suffered some kind of an oppression or violence to get here?
The academy serves refugees, asylees, and other immigrant youth who have been affected by crisis. They're students that we are resettling ourselves, the International Rescue Committee. They're asylees who are being referred to us by other organizations, by schools, or actually by families through word of mouth. The school was created along with other youth programs in New York City in 1999 when there were refugees fleeing the former Yugoslavia. All of a sudden, there was a large population of young people who needed educational support. And so a variety of youth programs developed to support those youth. The demand for those services has never gone down. The impetus behind the school is really to provide that extra leg up and that head start to develop or maintain a positive attitude towards school. Many of our students come very highly motivated and with a really positive attitude towards school. But the reality is that English language learners in New York City graduate at, you know, maybe 35% to 40% compared to proficient students, which is closer to 65-70%. That's a big gap that we have to take into consideration and help them to access needed services, acclimate in a positive way, and have an experience of success during the summer so that they know what that success feels like. So then when it starts getting hard, they've already tasted success, and that's going to help to drive them further. Most of our students are very, very strong individuals who have a lot of resiliency, and we need to tap into that and teach them how to keep tapping into that so that they're going to be able to do that in not only in the year ahead of them, but all the years that take them towards graduation.
Things are changing a little bit now. I mean, there's been a lot of talk now, obviously, about the Syrian refugees, and now since the Paris bombings, things are shifting again. Looking forward, what do you think is going to be the fate of these Syrian refugees sort of overall with respect to the school to make a dent?
We have resettled Syrians before. We'll continue to do so. Syrians, their lives looked a lot like our lives before it was disrupted by this political crisis. They had jobs. They had families. Their children attended school. But as children begin to arrive in New York City and their families are resettled, they're going to be very successful.
One of the things that I find so challenging and potentially barely exhilarating is the similarity and the differences between the refugee children that come from some completely different kinds of places, but there are some commonalities, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are commonalities in the types of challenges that they have faced in coming to the United States. As you saw in the film, many of their families were separated for 5 years, 10 years, and they go through this process of having to get to know each other again and to reestablish the roles in the family. There are many challenges that are happening inside and outside of school that these students are going to share. There's the challenges for families who arrive intact. There are a lot of new, you know, power dynamics and things that are taking place as children acculturate typically faster than their parents, and they gain information, and they're starting to learn how to use that information to their advantage. The students, no matter where they come from, they will negotiate these similar types of challenges. And I think you can see in the film, they really bond over that. There are friendships that are made at the Summer Academy. They're a lifetime friendship.
That was Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Zimbabwe is introducing a new land tax for resettled black farmers, many of whom are already struggling. Some have been teaming up with white commercial farmers displaced more than a decade ago by the government's controversial land reform program. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
The government says it will start charging black farmers who have benefited from Zimbabwe's land reform program between $3 and $10 a hectare per year in January 2016. The government is looking for revenue amid a seemingly sinking economy. The move is not worth because the land tax was one of the reasons that nationalists like President Robert Mugabe started the War of Liberation in the 1960s. Under Zimbabwe's land reform program, which began in year 2000, the government confiscated thousands of white-owned commercial farms and redistributed the land to black farmers. Mr. Mugabe said it was aimed at correcting colonial imbalances. But because they lacked financial capital and equipment, the newly resettled farmers have struggled with the demands of commercial farming. To help themselves, many have started partnering with displaced white commercial farmers, employing them as land managers or consultants. Douglas Mombeshora, Zimbabwe's lands and resettlement minister, says this is illegal.
To this we say no. While we understand that as government, we have not been able to fully support our farmers and financial institutions are not keen to lend money to them, we don't see subleasing as a solution. Government has agreed to joint ventures, partnerships and contract farming, provided the farmers bring their applications to the minister for approval.
He says those applications will not be approved if one of the partners is a former white commercial farmer. Still, the arrangements have continued to spread since about 2009. One farmer who grows soybeans and tobacco just outside Harare and who asked that his name not be used because of the sensitivity nature of the issue says he got his 10 hectares in year 2000 as part of the land reform program. He says he and other black farmers have no collateral to get loans, but the former commercial farmers had established relationships with banks, so they teamed up and they get shares in the farming businesses. That way, he added, I know at the end of the season that I have something and the white farmer has something as well. The Commercial Farmers Union of Zimbabwe, which represents 6,000 farmers displaced from their land, told VOA the government is not responding to their request for authorization to farm. Critics of the land reform program say the policy was meant to punish the farmers who were supporting the political opposition. Detractors blame the land reform program for perennial food shortages. The United Nations says 1.5 million people in Zimbabwe may need food aid this year. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A team of international observers has arrived in Juba, capital of the troubled Republic of South Sudan, to establish a monitoring and verification mechanism to ensure adherence to the cessation of hostilities agreement reached last month between the government and rebels contesting its authority. Members of the monitoring and verification group will ultimately allow both sides a way in which to report any breaches of the agreement. The United States strongly supports these efforts and urges both the government and opposition leader Riek Machar to lend their unqualified support to the establishment of the mechanism. South Sudan's leaders need to fully implement the cessation of hostilities and start an inclusive political dialogue to pave the way for national reconciliation. Seven political detainees have been released to date and have publicly stated their support for a peaceful resolution to a political crisis that erupted into violence and subsequently took on ethnic dimensions. The government agreed on January 23rd to the release of all detainees, but four remain in custody. The expeditious release and transfer of all prisoners would reduce tension and build confidence in an inclusive reconciliation process and peace dialogue. We urge the government to free the remaining four opposition leaders being held and ensure their security, as well as that of their families and associates. We will continue to partner with others in the international community, in particular with the UN mission in South Sudan, working under difficult and dangerous conditions there to alleviate the suffering and protect innocent civilians affected by the crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials. One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.